In-house Transportation Committee together. It's Thursday, March the 13th at about 1:26. We have a quorum in the Senate, and I think the rest of the members will be here, but in the Senate we have Senator Olson, Senator Wagner, and myself. And I'd like to introduce the co-chair here. He can introduce the House members.
In the House, I'm Representative Holm. We have Representative Kukesh, Representative Hines, Representative Coring, and Representative... what is your name, sir? Are you on the Transportation Committee, sir?
No, I'm not.
Representative Rookberg.
I'm visiting.
And I have a vested interest, Mr. Chairman.
The purpose of this meeting is just for an overview of what's happening at the airport and give us an update. And I'd like to ask the Commissioner of Transportation to maybe introduce his people for the audience. Maybe if you could come up and so we can get it picked up. We have people online that's listening.
We have Kip Knudsen, the Deputy Commissioner for Aviation. Dave Everly is the Regional Director for the Central Region, as well as the Project Manager for the Terminal Project. Mort Plum, the Airport Director. Dennis Bouchard, who's our Legislative Liaison. Lee Selkrag, who's the consultant working on this project. And we have Ken Sura, also a consultant on the phone.
Okay. And I'd like to say that we have, due to the weather, I think Cliff Argo was going to be here, but he's online, and he's off nap. And so I think that's it. So if you'd like to come forward and start this and give us some... And we'll try to hold the questions until after... Well, if you have any particular questions about anyone, you can certainly ask it, but this is an overview.
That's correct. We're here today to bring you up to date on the terminal restoration project at the Anchorage Airport. We want to tell you where we are, how we got here, and where we're going. But first, before I turn it over to others, let me just provide a little background. All the operations at Anchorage Airport are self-funded. The revenues are generated by rates and fees on the tenants and users of the airport, as well as federal dollars on the capital side, some federal dollars. There are no general funds involved. We have an arrangement with the airlines. It defines our business relationship. It's called the Airlines Operating Agreement, or the Airport Operating Agreement. And that essentially serves as a contract between the airport and the airlines. Our goal at that airport is to run it in a safe and efficient manner that meets the needs of Alaskans and others in the traveling public, as well as providing service for a lot of cargo carriers that pass through the airport. We all want an airport that Alaskans can be proud of, and that's what we're working towards. We already introduced the crew here. As the chairman mentioned, Cliff Argue is on the phone, and as I understand it, also Chuck Johnson and Paul Landis of Era Aviation are also on the phone. Cliff serves as the chair of the airport's Airlines Affairs Committee, and he's also vice president for properties at Alaska Airlines. Dave Everly, the project manager, will tell you where we are, and then Kip is going to discuss where we're going. And Mort Plum at the end will give you an update on last night's storm and what happened at the airport last night. Mort was up most of the night with that, so if he looks a little sleepy or sleepier than he usually does, that's why. So, but with that, let me turn it over to Dave.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good.
I'm
state your name and spell your last name for the benefit of the...
I'm David Eberle, E-B-E-R-L-E. I'm the program director for the Territory Development Project and Central Region Director for Alaska DOT. What I'd like to do is give you an update on the Terminal Redevelopment Project, the current status of construction, some of the challenges we've run into, cost increases we've incurred. But in order to do that, let me first perhaps refresh memories of folks here. Some of you may have been not involved. The scope of the Terminal Redevelopment Project, it's a $230 million project, and it basically has three elements. There's a landside element, which involves building a new access road into the terminal, extending the upper ramp and lower curbside ramps, bringing in a new access route for taxis and buses to separate them from the passenger traffic, creating an area for rental cars, and encompassed all the parking within the road system. That's the roadside portion. Most of that was funded with FHWA funding, with exception of the parking area, which was not eligible for FHWA funding. The terminal itself is outlined here in multicolors. That's one of the other features, was to build a new concourse, a new core area, and then come back and renovate the existing terminal. We also have airside features associated with the Terminal Redevelopment Project, consisting of a new apron along Concourse C, a new apron off of A, and then some apron work along and between B and A. There was also a remain overnight hard stand, which was part of the project. Basically, if aircraft are staying overnight but have no need to be at the terminal, they need a concrete pad to park on or they sink into the asphalt. Then there's one other element which is not shown on this particular drawing. It's a remote fueling site which will probably be on the west side of the north-south runway. So that's sort of the scope of the $230 million project, and I'll get into some updates on where the status is.
Just ask one question. There's a railroad, new railroad terminal out there. How was that funded?
That was funded totally separate. It was a federal grant to the railroad, and that facility is shown right here.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted that on the record.
Okay. I'd also like to touch just briefly on the history here. I've got a chronology of the whole project. Back in 1996, the project started, and it started with a needs assessment. The airport knew that there were deficiencies in terms of meeting the passenger needs. Queuing areas at the ticket lobby were very long. Baggage claim was sparse. It was a very crowded condition. There was demand for gates that weren't being met, but we needed to somehow quantify that. So back in 96, we started with what's known as a needs assessment, to identify what the needs are, and then from those needs go into what are the design options. Needs forecast was coordinated with the airport and the airlines and all the users. We then began a master planning process, which basically identified potential solutions to the problem. Tear down a concourse, build a new concourse, build a whole new concourse somewhere else, add on to it, add a pier. A variety of options were looked at. And as a result of about a year's effort, we ended up with a concept design that the airlines felt would meet the needs for themselves, the airport felt it met the passenger needs, and also met the concessionaire needs. That concept design was then presented to the airlines, and there was extensive coordination through that whole year period with the airlines. And in November of 1997, they agreed to the concept design and a $230 million budget. We then brought that forward to the legislature in early 1998. And the legislature approved $175 million worth of revenue bonds that year in 1998. And with that as sort of a background of history, let me get into the current status. Chairman Cowder?
Yeah, would any of the members like the lights turned down to see this PowerPoint? Is it okay or what?
How hard is it to turn it down?
It's just a switch.
Well, we don't want to turn it off, I don't think.
How's that?
That's fine.
Okay. Yeah, please continue. Let me, you know, since we're going through here, and I might forget, when you did the original design, you did the tear down. Did you run into any unexpected expenses in the demolition of, what was that, that concourse?
Old Concourse C. There was quite a bit of asbestos work that needed to be done.
Was that anticipated?
Some was anticipated, but not the level that we encountered. The same when we went into moving the regional carriers, we ran into additional asbestos problems there. And the whole terminal has a major problem there.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You made a reference to the railroad facility that was out there, and you said that it was built with federal funds. How is it going to be maintained?
I would refer that question to the railroad, but I believe the railroad has an operating plan for it, and it's a railroad facility. They have to operate and maintain it. The airport does not own it.
Do they pay rent for the space?
Mark Plum could probably address that question better than I.
Okay, we'll...
We don't have to get into it now, but I just had that lingering question that's been asked of me.
I believe they do. I had asked that question before, but just for the record, if there's any for the committee.
Okay. Anyway, overall, the entire project is about 57% complete. The elements that are complete, the utility relocations are done. We've demolished the old Concourse C. The regional airlines have been relocated. They were previously along the old C. They are now in between A and B, and that will hopefully be their permanent location. All the landside work is done. And the RON apron that I mentioned earlier, that is completed. The first phase of Concourse C, which was the structural elements and the foundations, that is complete. We are now into the second phase of Concourse C construction, which is the completion contract, and that's about 43% complete. The total funding for the project that's been authorized is $254 million, which is the $230 plus interest earnings up until last year, and expended to date is about $175 million. In terms of the schedule, the yellow line here represents Concourse C. The white elements here are all completed. Concourse C, phase one is done. We're about 43% done with phase two. This blue line represents the tenant build-out. The plan is to open the new facility in May of 04, but prior to opening up, the airlines and the concessionaires need between 4 and 6 months to actually build their facilities so that when we open the doors, they're ready to operate. So that's shown by this blue line. The remodel of the existing terminal, South Terminal, coming back and upgrading it for seismic conditions and new security issues and such, that's this area, and it's represented by this line, and we just now are starting that design process. We're into it about a month. The other elements that are remaining, North Terminal Connector, the remote refueling, those could be timed just about any time, and the aprons off of A have to be built in conjunction with the remodel whenever we do that. With respect to completing Concourse C itself, this is just a blow-up of Concourse C completion contract. One of the critical elements is putting in the baggage handling system, and that baggage handling system has been impacted by the new TSA security requirements. So this baggage system right now is going to take about 9 months to complete and install. We've just recently sent our proposed solution to the baggage screening problem to TSA for their approval. We think they're going to get their approval. Assuming they can deliver their equipment in a timely fashion, we should be able to make this schedule. If their equipment doesn't come in, then this schedule could be in jeopardy. Tenant improvements are shown here. We'll have a startup and commissioning period, and the target date again is opening May 4th of 04. Back when we developed the concept design for this project, a lot of things have changed since then. The original concept design was this area here, plus this gray area and the blue. Shortly after the concept design was approved, we then sat down with the airlines to work through the details of actual space layouts. The concept design is really nothing more than a sketch with some estimates of what the space was going to be in terms of square footage requirements, and then an estimated cost on square footage based on what we were seeing for construction prices in those days. When we actually sat down, put pen to paper to work out a floor plan that worked for everybody, the area grew significantly. First off, regional carriers were going to be here. We ended up moving them in this area. This blue section, which was going to be an expansion, was then deleted from that part, but the concourse over here grew to accommodate the additional gates and the additional concessionaire space that was needed. So over from the time that the concept was approved to the time that we went out with the final design, about a 2-year period, About 86,000 square feet were added to the terminal. Original size of the new terminal was about 420, so we're approaching 500,000 square foot for the additional area. The cost, roughly, for that 86,000 square feet is about $22 million. And our plan that we worked with the airlines was that because of that increased scope, the interest earnings on the bonds as they were sitting in the construction fund would be used to basically pay that increased scope for the added square footage. One of the things we did not count on was the permit delays that we ran into. Back when we were developing the designs, and on this timeline, and you have a copy of this, the upper portion of this is really airline coordination, legislative approvals, and just a few key dates. The lower line here is really the design process, the interface with the municipality relative to permitting, and then the construction dates. Anyway, after we developed the design, we submitted it to the municipality of Anchorage for building permit approval, and that's required by state law right now. Unfortunately, at that time, the municipality would not accept the building permit application without 100% drawings. What happened is that we were expecting a relatively quick turnaround on that building permit and expected the building permit in May of that year. Senator?
Yeah. Ron Watts, I believe, was the chief engineer in the project. I was in contact with him a couple years ago, whenever that was, when
right.
He was having problems. And, of course, there's two sides to every story, but I know there was concrete that was in the original plans that wasn't adequate for the thought, and I don't know if it was the city, I don't know whether you guys' fault or the engineering firm, your consultants, but it's probably a combination of them all. And anyway, did you have any questions?
Well, I was just curious why it took so long, if that's what you're...
I can get into some of that detail right now.
Sure.
Anyway, after we submitted the original drawings, and we were expecting the permit in May of that year, the municipality's engineer got to looking at the drawings, and he found some basic assumption errors on the part of the engineer relative to some of the loading under seismic conditions, and then he found a number of inconsistencies between the final design that the structural engineer put together and the mathematical model that he used to analyze the stresses. So early in the process, the engineer agreed that some of the loading assumptions were wrong, made some changes. Well, we meanwhile had already awarded this contract because it was bidding at the same time that the municipality was looking at it. So we immediately had to issue a change order to our contractor to modify the steel. Some of the steel was upgraded in sizes. Because of the errors that the municipality found, they then dug into the model in detail. And for almost 6 months, we were arguing about whether the model accurately represented the design. And during that whole 6 month period, our contractor was basically on hold. They were releasing foundations on a very piecemeal basis for those that they agreed were adequate, but those where the mathematical model was critical, they would not agree to permit those until the model was complete and accurate in their own.
Can you give us an approximate cost of that delay? Have you have any percentage?
You're getting ahead of me, Senator.
Okay. and Representative Rookberg had a question.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Everly, perhaps you can want to take this up later, but I did want to posit the question about whether or not you think you would have experienced this level of delay if, in fact, the state and the municipality had submitted the structural and all plans to a outside third-party plan reviewer, for example, the International Conference of Building Officials. Do you think that would have helped you allay or avoid this problem?
I believe it would. In fact, there was a legislative audit on this very issue of the permitting process and what took place, and there's a report that was issued in May of last year. And in that report, they make a specific recommendation relative to the current law, and their recommendation is to provide some flexibility so that the state can select, in lieu of going through the local permitting process, a third-party engineering firm to perform that function. That does a couple of things for us. Number one is a third-party firm has many more resources than the municipality permitting department. They are basically relying on one or two structural engineers. by the state electing to hire a third party to do that permitting review for code compliance, we can bring whatever resources we need to that to expedite the process. We would also bring them on early in the design process so that as our engineer is working, he's making submissions to this third party. So some of the basic design assumptions, if he's wrong, the third party was going to catch him right then and there.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
This is a pretty common
type of a procedure even before this project. And why didn't the state elect to do this initially?
Well, at that point, it was not all that common for the municipality.
I can tell you it is pretty common in the private and commercial building area.
It is.
Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
You mentioned after contract were let, you issued change orders, which would be, I would take it pretty much up front before the actual construction begin. Did those change orders persist to the present time? In other words, were they pretty much front-loaded, those change orders, or
no,
have you
not.
Had trouble with change orders since?
The change orders continued right up until and shortly after I got the permit, which was exactly 2 years later than I anticipated.
So that would
During that two-year period, there were numerous change orders issued as the design engineer was issuing design corrections, basically.
And, Mr. Chairman, follow up, that would then have increased the cost appreciably, correct?
Definitely. Very much so.
Senator Wagner. Well, I'm having a little trouble following this. So your original engineer.
Consultant.
Your consultant.
Right.
Was corrected by the engineers of the city.
That's correct.
Does the original engineer have errors and omissions insurance?
Yes. The state has owner-controlled insurance program over the whole project. So that we place the insurance for all the contractors working on there, and we also place the policy for errors and omissions, $10 million error and omission policy. We have placed that carrier on notice that we intend to file a claim against the insurance policy and submitting our cost. Now that we know what those costs are, we're working with the AG's office to basically pursue our claim.
So it looks like we're about 50% under insured on that.
At least, yes. If I could continue. Anyway, this diagram here basically shows the impact of the schedule caused by permitting. That was our original schedule. As a result of the permitting delays, which is basically shown in this area, it pushed the anticipated completion date out to here. And that's at the point that I was bidding the Phase 2 completion contract. Phase 1 was already underway. Because the permit was not issued till after the Phase 2 contract was awarded, there was some additional changes made at the point where both contractors were out there. In fact, some of the Phase 1 work had to be shifted to the Phase 2 work, so I didn't have both contractors stumbling over each other. That, in turn, pushed the schedule out another 6 months to where we are today, which is May of 2004.
Did the contractors turn in claims for these delays?
The contractors have been turning in requests for change orders based on the changes as they're issued, and we've been negotiating those with the contractor all along.
None of them been settled?
Very many of them have been settled. We fully anticipate we'll be able to settle all the issues without a formal claim. The contractor's been working very cooperatively with us, trying to minimize the cost and keep the project moving forward. This is basically the bottom line of what the permitting costs are. Now that we have the permit in hand, and by and large all the changes have been issued, we're fairly comfortable that these are the kinds of costs we're going to see when it's all said and done and the contract change orders are all negotiated. So this is basically in the order we're looking at. So that's the permitting issue. Unfortunately, at the same time that we're working through the permitting problems, September 11th comes along. We had just awarded Phase 2 contract, and about a week, 10 days later, 911. As a result of that, back in that time frame, FAA was still in charge of the security issues, and they issued the 100% bag screening mandate. No one really knew what that meant in terms of immediate needs as well as what it was going to do to this project. We've worked through that process now. We've submitted our proposed plan to to TSA, who is now the agency in charge, and they are reviewing our plan relative to Concourse C. But the TSA security issues hit the airport in three different ways. There were the immediate needs relative to passenger screening that was dealt with. There's some interim measures that Mort can explain a little bit later, but those are going to take place this summer. And then the long-term permanent needs affect Concourse C in terms of what we're building and the baggage system we're putting in, and will also impact the remodel job when we come back to remodel the existing terminal. This area right in here, which is about a half acre in size, this area, we ended up having to take this entire area to put in the new screening machines and the new bag belt systems. That area is eventually going to have to be made up because originally it was planned for maintenance and it ultimately was going to be used as a United makeup area. So we've stolen that makeup area and now we're going to have to add it somewhere under the remodel job to have adequate area for the makeup as well as the additional screening area for the TSA requirements. So the remodel job is completely different from anything we envisioned at the concept level, and I'll address that a little bit further. But anyway, the cost relative to security issues, we're sort of a high-low right now because we're waiting for prices from our contractor as well as TSA approval. And we're talking somewhere between $18 and $23 million just to Concourse C. Relative to the remodel, we're talking about probably the same order of magnitude, and then there's interim cost, and Mort could talk a little bit about those. So getting sort of to the bottom line of this whole thing, there were three major events that occurred that increased the cost of this project. One is the square footage, as I addressed earlier. We had a plan for that. We were going to use our interest earnings. The two that we did not plan on or count on was the permit delays, about $33 million, and the security impacts, another $23 million. All total, that comes to $308 million.
On the, since we talked about this a couple, 3 years ago when we got started, till now, the airline industry's really taken a beating, and is like United and Delta and everything still going to be utilized at the original expectations, or are they going to, what's your...
I think that's a good question for Mort to, that you could hit him with later, but we have to make some assumptions.
Senator Massey.
Thank you.
Representative Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering what projects could the airport defer or cancel to help absorb the cost overruns associated with the terminal redevelopment?
Chair Massey, we'll get into that right at the end of my presentation, and Deputy Commissioner Knudsen will address some of that. So going to, you saw the 308 is what my projected need is to finish this. The current funding, the original 204 in bonds, the revenue bonds, along with the FHWA portion, would made up to 230 interest earnings. $24 million in interest earnings have been appropriated by the legislature on two increments. So we have $254 million that was authorized. Currently, there are about $5 million of additional interest earnings sitting there on the bond monies. We'll be asking the legislature to appropriate those. So basically, we have about $259 million available today. Our estimate of completion, 308. Net funding need is about $50 million, $49 million. What makes this relatively urgent is that based on my current cash flow projections, to finish the Concourse C, take care of some of the additional security needs, et cetera, I'm projecting that by September or October of this year, we will literally run out of money. So I need to get an additional funding source between now and this fall. Now, relative to the South Terminal, basically, the scope of this, again, has changed significantly as a result of TSA, the seismic information we know, the asbestos problems. There are lots of unknowns associated with what the remodel is going to be. The airlines, and as I mentioned, we just now hired an engineering firm to start the design process. Back in September and October, when we first discussed this with the airlines, they're very anxious to get a big picture of what we think it's going to cost because they need to put together a long-term business plan. So we sat down with the airlines, brought in a few consultants, and took a first look at what it might cost to do the remodel and what the timing of that remodel would be. And that's basically what these numbers represent. The existing terminal area is about 300,000 square feet. Based on what we've experienced to date relative to cost, we're We're using a figure of $295 a square foot as a remodel cost. We're going to need roughly, and again, this is a rough number, 30,000 square feet of additional space to make up for the space we stole, the additional space for TSA security, as well as the potential that regional carriers will have to screen their passengers as well. If that occurs, we're going to need some vertical circulation between secure upstairs and secure downstairs. So the assumption here is that that's about $370 a square foot. We'll put a couple of years' worth of escalation in here because we probably won't start construction until about 2005. Our best guess now is about $108 million to come back and remodel the existing terminal. The immediate need there is we've started the design process. We want to be in a position so that when the new terminal opens, that within about 6 months, we could bid the contracts for the remodel. The airlines are very anxious to get the entire project done so that everybody's on an equal footing relative to the remodeled facility. Subtracting that from the 108 is about $95 million that we would need for construction. So what does that mean in terms of funding request? The FY04 needs that we're projecting, the complete Concourse C, the $50 million that I showed you earlier, we also want to continue the design of the South Terminal, and there's a little bit of preparatory work in there for being able to shuffle the airlines once we're ready to make the move. That's about $13 million. So the net for this fiscal year is $63 million. We're anticipating that in 05, we will come back once the design has been advanced on the South Terminal. We know what we're going to build. We'll have a much better cost estimate. At that point, we'd be coming back looking for a revenue bonding issue to take care of the South Terminal. And that's the estimated $95 million. The other thing I might point out is that in addition to the terminal project, the airport has an ongoing CIP program. And as part of the operating agreement that the commissioner mentioned, there was a plan for a CIP revenue bond issue to cover the years 04 through 06. And Deputy Commissioner Knutson will be talking about that right now. This concludes what I was going to present to you. If you have some questions for me, I gladly answer those. Commissioner Knutson can come up and talk about what the anticipated funding arrangements are, the dialogue we've had with the airlines to date, some of the projects that Representative Masick was interested in as far as what was going to be deferred. He can address those. Any questions?
Senator Wagner.
I just kind of boggles my mind. I assume that the original design engineering firm is no longer with the state.
Well, they are the engineer of record. So until we physically complete all the construction, we have to rely on them. If there's any issues relative to the design, they need to be the ones to address those. So they're still on board dealing with our contractors as issues come up.
Representative Masick.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm just really, really puzzled as to, you know, since our 1964 earthquake and then the one we had just last year, why wasn't all of this taken into consideration? We all know we live on a fault line that's alive with earthquakes all the time. I mean, it's just criminal as far as I'm concerned to see that it was overlooked. It's just slap in the face to the state that we didn't even considered, you know, looking at this earthquake issue and having to go back now and spend additional funding for something that these engineers should have known about. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It was not overlooked. The problem was the engineer made some erroneous assumptions. In our mind, there's clearly an error on the engineering side here. The other part of this is the interpretation of the prevailing code. How do you interpret that code relative to the design issues? And that's a lot of what we got embroiled with the municipality, is the interpretation of that code, what it does to the model, and then in turn, what does that do to the design? So it isn't that we ignored it. In fact, it was specifically in our contract with our designer that he had to build it to the current code, including the seismic. And part of his mission and responsibility, written right in the contract, is it has to be a design that is permittable. And getting the permit is part of their function.
Who was responsible for determining the engineering firm that did this?
It was a competitive selection process early.
Low bidder?
Back in this time frame. No, it's not based on a low bid. It's based on their experience, their credentials, the team they were going to put together. Alaska Hire came into it as an additional factor, but it's a combination of experience and their work history. So it's not a low bid scenario.
If you had it to do over again, would you do something different?
Relative to the remodel, one of the things we're doing right now is looking at a possible different way of delivering that. We've hired a consulting firm to do the design work, and we've started that process. One of the things we're looking at possibly doing is bringing on the construction contractor during the design process. It wouldn't be a hard money bid process. It would be a request for proposals, competitive proposals. Picking a construction firm that has good experience in this type of a scenario. Basically, it's a CM at risk, where the construction contractor comes on board while you're still doing the design. He's out there with the designer making decisions as to how the design is going to be put together. How are you going to approach the construction? So he has the construction input as they're doing the design. He's also well aware of what's out there or not out there, because his team's out there at the same time the designer's out there. After the design is advanced to a certain level, we then sit down with that contractor, negotiate a hard money contract, and all the risk becomes his. He's basically bought into the design, he knows what's there, and he gives us a hard money number.
Senator Wagner,
I guess the other thing I'm having a hard time grasping is, I've built commercial facilities, I grew up in a construction family, and I have never known of any project to proceed until I had a building permit. The last thing I do is bid the project out before the engineering work's done, the architectural work done, and I have a building permit in hand. I mean, that's the normal progression of things. What you got $22.1 million here in construction charges relating to the lack of a permit. So a general contractor apparently was brought on board prior to you receiving a permit, right?
That's correct. The reason that occurred mainly was in the interest of bringing the project on early. The desire was to have this terminal operating in the tourist season.
I guess we shouldn't do that anymore.
That is definitely a risk that does not necessarily always pay off.
Representative Rookford.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. Very briefly, Mr. Everly. Just so I get clarified and for the committee's purposes, the South Terminal additional cost, I reckon to be just for the design and the renovation, not including the new area, I add up to about $104 million, exclusive of the new terminal area and the, but including the design work. Now, it was, if my recollections are correct, the $230 million of the initial project was to include the subsequent renovation of the existing terminal. Is that true, or?
That was the original anticipation, yes, that we had about $30 million available to do that.
So the public can understand this then. That means that in terms of the other burdens that you've outlined, and I understand that, from a cash flow standpoint, you have utilized all the monies that were allocated to not only build the new Concourse C and the other surrounding improvements, but as well as you've burned up the cash to do the renovations on the existing terminal. That's why you're going to have to come and make a request of the legislature for further funding. Would that be
yes, about accurate? About half of the original $30 million was used to partially renovate and move the regional carriers. And then the balance of that is basically deferred to these other project costs.
And that's in spite of the fact that you actually cut back the scope of the work on the new terminal existence already. Now, is that not true? The existing terminal was to be expanded further, but you've reduced the size of that expansion. Is that correct?
No, that's not.
Well, the blue line that you have on the one, it shows that on the south terminal on the.
So you're saying the scope of the south terminal remodel.
The model was reduced and should have cut some costs there already, though. Is that correct?
Well, that would have been new construction added on to the existing terminal.
Right. Yeah, they're referring to the deletion of this section.
That's correct. So, right.
That was supposed to be the other part. But you already actually should have received some savings there. So notwithstanding the savings you received by reducing the scope of the south terminal, you still need this additional amount of money.
Right. But the net increase in C is offset by that. And that increase is 86,000 more than we anticipated, even with that blue area.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Everly, I think I'd like to weigh in like Senator Wagner. Why was the contract let without a building permit? What is the answer to that?
As I explained, it was a desire to get the terminal completed and opened in time for the 2002 tourist season.
I don't know that that's a good answer, sir. Did any heads roll because we had a $33 million overrun cost because of this?
At the time we let the contracts, we certainly did not anticipate this kind of a difficulty relative to the permit. And we met with the municipality before the permit, or before the contract was awarded. Early indications were that it looked like the permit could be issued within 70 days. On that basis, we made the award. After the award was made, the problem started cropping up.
Is there any other questions? Senator Olson, do you have any questions at this time? And Senator Wagner will come up next.
The only question that I have is, you've certainly concentrated on the building project that's going on with the terminal. Who is going to be presenting some of the other capital projects that are going on around the airport proper?
Deputy Commissioner Knutson will talk about those briefly.
Okay.
Senator Wagner?
Please forgive me, I'm not trying to be argumentative, but is it common practice for the city of Anchorage to allow construction to start on a project of this magnitude without a building permit? Every time I've been involved in a construction project in my area or outside where I came from, if you didn't have that construction permit, you didn't start construction.
Having worked with the municipality for 6 or so years, and in public works, we did issue permits, conceptual permits for foundation work and things to get in the ground early so they could work in the winter. That was fairly common that we did that. That has been fairly common in the past when I was there. So you can answer to it.
The answer to your question, Senator, is that yes, the municipalities not allow construction to proceed without permits. They were allowing it on an incremental basis as they had confidence in a foundation for a particular feature. They would release a partial permit, and on that basis is how we were proceeding with construction. The problem was that solving all those problems took over a year, and the ripple effect and getting the design changes done took the additional year before the final permit was issued. But we were getting permits on an incremental basis as features were redesigned and agreed to by the municipality.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Everly, it was your testimony that the specifications of the contracts that were entered into with your structural engineers, Kaufman Engineering, were such that the state assumed or specified the scope of the E&O insurance to be covered by the contract, and therefore allowed the company's insurance not to be subject to this contract, or do they have additional E&O coverage above and beyond the $10 million policy you indicated?
It's typical for projects, large projects in particular, that you place separate coverage for those projects. In our contract with the design firm and the architectural firm, we could either place the insurance through them or we could place it ourselves through the state. We chose to place it through the state as an owner-controlled policy at a better rate.
So any additional E&O coverage they may have, as a matter of practice, would not cover their any wrongdoing or failure or omissions on their part?
Really a legal question. I don't have the answer to that.
Is there any hope for recovery out of that theory?
I wouldn't place a lot of hope in it, but it's certainly a question I can pose before the AG's office.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Hines, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you please tell me, in the permit delay cost of $33 million, could you break some of that down for me? What's involved in there, in the 33?
There is a breakdown in the handout. the construction portion of it is $22 million. The permit review process, and one of the things that I may have not mentioned, is that we brought on a third-party engineer. The municipality dealt with this for about 6 months. It became pretty obvious that this was a bigger problem than that they could handle in terms of staffing. We brought on a third-party engineering firm to do these reviews on behalf of the municipality and work out the issues, the design issues, with our designer. The permit review process and that third-party reviewer and the design changes are the $3.8 million. The administration of the construction is the $3.6 million. That's basically our people overseeing the construction contractor for that extended almost two-year window. And then the project administration, legal, that's DOT personnel and legal aspects and extended office space and things of that nature. So that's rough breakdown of the various areas that the cost were incurred, the bulk of it being in the construction.
Thank you. We got others here. One last question on the delay. Was a claim made for mobilization, demobilization, and things like that in that area by the contractors?
The contractor remained mobilized on the site, but he was limited as to what he could work on. So some of his subcontractors came and went as there was work available. So partially, yes.
Okay, thank you, Dave. We might have you back up here in a little bit, but the next stuff that I think is, identify yourself and who you represent, or your position, rather.
Yes, sir. Kip Knutson, I am third week on the job as Deputy Commissioner for Aviation and Department of Transportation. Now that Mr. Eberle has softened you all up, I'll go through the fun stuff. Just to indicate to you how healthy the airport system is in the state, the system is going to be able to absorb these cost increases. So if I can put a positive spin on it, let me start out that way. And let me diverge just a little bit. Since the TRP was, and I'll use the shortening if that's okay, the Terminal Redevelopment Project, since it was conceived, passenger traffic has been up annually 1.8%. And so just in a few years after that terminal is open, it will be operating at full capacity if these numbers continue. The airport system is up over 4% annually. And globally, cargo operations are on the rise, and there's a very bullish forecast for international cargo. Now, this works out very well for us because within the operating agreement, the system is self-funded, and we charge fees to the various people who operate at the airport. 79% of revenues are derived from cargo operations. 40% of the revenues are derived from international cargo operators. So the good thing about this whole program right now is that we have a fairly rosy outlook into the future, and a lot of the fees and a lot of this project are being underwritten by our friends in the cargo business. The only drawback is that these operators also track their costs by fractions of pennies. So from a business perspective, the system is going to have to watch fees extremely carefully to make sure that we don't start driving operators to other areas in the world. In the passenger market, our passenger business in the system is represented by two carriers. We have national passenger carriers, and we have our regional. For the national carriers, Anchorage is an extremely good deal. Compared to any airport that a Northwest or a Delta or an Alaska operates into, Anchorage and Fairbanks are an extremely good deal as far as fees. For regional carriers, obviously Anchorage is the most expensive airport that they operate into. So again, we have kind of an interesting mix of business that the business model always has to be aware of. Again, on that operating agreement, it's a business arrangement between the airlines and the state primarily, and it contains obviously the coverage of operating costs. It contains coverage for the TRP, and it also envisions a five-year capital improvement program.
Representative Massey, do you have a question?
On that point, yes, yeah. Mr. Chairman, on you were talking about the cargo operations, and as a major contribution or contributor to airport revenue, you know, they do bring a lot of money in, but some of them are gas and go airlines. They're increasingly becoming more capable of overflying Anchorage. What impacts do you see that could possibly have on the long-term effect of the airport, the cargo department?
Well, that's a, I mean, obviously, we have to watch those customers very carefully, and we have to make sure that Anchorage remains such a good deal that they will continue to trade fuel for cargo. What they're doing is they're loading more cargo into the airplane and stopping in Anchorage for fuel because it's worth it to them. The costs that they pay by landing are far less than what they make by hauling the extra cargo. So we just have to continue to watch that our fees don't change that calculation for them. And that's obviously a major focus within the marketing departments at both Anchorage and Fairbanks.
And on that topic of aviation, Mr. Chairman, how many airlines utilizing the airport are delinquent in their payments, or to what extent do you see the potential for default or bankruptcy on some of those carriers?
Despite the shaky nature of the industry, we only have one carrier that's currently late, and it's only 90 days. Everybody else is current.
Is it a large amount of money?
No.
Let's just put it,
it's an Alaska-based carrier.
Does that help? Representative Bates, did you have a question?
Thank you.
It's not a 121, right?
Yes, it is a 121 carrier.
Mr. Chairman, on that point.
Okay.
How much traffic does UAL and AMR have in the TSAIA
In the what? I'm sorry?
In the airport.
Oh, Ted Stevens. Right. How much do they have as far as volume?
Yeah.
Relative percentages? Oh, well, you know, Alaska's the big heavy as far as passenger traffic, and then it drops off precipitously after that. But Northwest, American, Delta, and Aera Aviation all trade places for 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th.
Well, American and UAL on the verge of bankruptcy. So I think Massey asked a very good question.
Yeah, you know, Alaska, and perhaps Mr. Argue can address that more specifically, but I think Alaska is planning that if they drop out of the market, there will be some flexibility within some other carrier's schedules to handle that traffic. So,
one question. Anchorage, or Ted Stevens Airport is a profitable venture for us?
Well, it's internally it's a break-even operation.
Is Fairbanks a break-even operation?
I understand the revenues, again, in the system, the revenues are generated at both airports and deposited into a central fund and then distributed again to pay for operations, but unfortunately, the Fairbanks Airport does not quite generate enough revenues to cover costs.
Representative Roper. Mr. Chairman, are you referring to approximately $5 million a year? And Mr. Knudsen, correct me if I'm wrong, that the Anchorage subsidizes Fairbanks? Is that what you're referring to, Mr. Chairman?
It's in that order, but we always look to our neighbors at the north. For example, last night when airplanes weren't available to land in Anchorage, we know that they had an alternative to land in Fairbanks. So.
Thank you.
Well noted. Mr. Chairman, I do hope that we continue our discussion on the Anchorage Airport.
Is that a point of order?
It is a under, okay. Representative Massey.
Just on that topic, too, with the cost overruns on the redevelopment portion of this is so excessive, does the airport feel revenue sharing with other airports in the system will or could be impacted?
No.
No?
There's no anticipated change for operations. Well, the only other airport that it would impact would be Fairbanks, and no. I mean, the ideal within the system is to maximize revenues, and that means the more operations, the better. So, and in fact, last night when Anchorage is closed, the nice thing about the system is we don't lose revenues because people land in Fairbanks.
Do you get their landing fees?
Yes. Well, they all feed into the same system. So, yeah.
Okay. Okay, we're run out here of time. Oh, you got a question?
No, I'm just giggling at
you. These are, I'm pleased that on the questioning because it does highlight how the system works, and I think that's a valuable discussion. Now, I was discussing the operating agreement envisions the terminal redevelopment project, operating expenses, obviously, and then the five-year capital improvement program. This was negotiated with the airlines 2 or 3 years ago and decided on a large amount. The first 2 years of that capital improvement program are underway. The legislature authorized expenditures. We sold bonds to cover the expenses. And let me note, in previous operating agreements, we used to cash fund capital programs. But what happened when we got into this terminal redevelopment project and the five-year CIP, we found out that cash funding wasn't going to cover it. So we've gone to a debt financing system in order to smooth out the costs of some of these larger and more ambitious projects. It has definitely smoothed out and drawn out fees over the longer term, but it also makes our flexibility within the system a little more complicated, as we're discovering when we get to the deferral issue of projects that we are planning to undertake. So at any rate, we've done the first 2 years of the five-year CIP. This year we're going to come back to you with the years 3, 4, and 5, and that brings me sort of into where we are with the discussions with the airlines. We're going to have to come to you this session to ask for an increase in our bonding cap. Currently it's at $448 million. We're going to need to increase it by a level somewhere between $80 and $100 million to cover the cost increases in the TRP and the 04, 05, and 06 capital improvement program. Right now, the airlines and the state are discussing many elements that are included in the business plan in order to try to incorporate these cost increases. I'm not going to get real specific because the conversations are ongoing, but that includes deferral of projects within the CIP. And again, this is somewhat limited because we have two major concerns. We need to utilize fully all federal funds that are coming into the state, and that of course requires match, and the right kind of projects have to be forwarded for competition with discretionary funds, etc. And then the other element is that when we sell bonds, we promise bondholders to complete certain projects. So we can only defer certain kinds of projects and transfer that money into the terminal project. We're looking at scope reductions, continued scope reductions within the TRP, as well as all the other projects that are being considered to be undertaken. We're going to use PFCs to continue to leverage our debt. This is a technique. It's just a leveraging technique. But we're
can you explain that?
Yeah, we collect $3 per passenger at the airport. It's a nationwide program, and they're generally designated to try to develop the passenger facilities that people use at the airport. Instead of using that dollar for dollar to pay for a project, we're using those dollars to leverage debt. In other words, we can generate more debt by using the PFCs to pay the debt service. It just spreads out the cost of this big program many years into the future. Keeps the rates down. We're going to use some cash from the airport's discretionary funds. We have a development fund within the airport system, which is intended to take care of emergency problems, development aspects that may occur. If a big tenant wanted to come in and need land developed, etc. So we're going to use some of that discretionary cash to help cover the costs. And we're going after this. I'm going to refer to the slide here. Obviously, we talked about revenue bonding, deferring project scope. We're going to go after the TSA to reimburse us for the costs that we have incurred in the CCON course. They have recently in Congress passed a bill which included, up to $700 million for these issues. But just to give you an idea of the magnitude, by the time we're done with concourses A, B, and C, our total security costs will be approximately $50 million. Dallas-Fort Worth is $250 million and LAX is $400 million. And Congress just passed a bill for $700 million. So we're going to be aggressive and we're going to be in their faces, but it's going to be a tough battle, obviously. Every time you see somebody from TSA, you can mention that we need their help. And then, of course, we're going to go after the errors and omissions policy. Okay, I've listed everything up there. Again, just to reiterate, we are going to be before you this year trying to increase our cap to to accommodate the completion of the C concourse to begin with. And then next year, we're going to be back with harder numbers, more solid numbers on the A and B renovation side of it. And I'll conclude with that and answer any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kip, I was interested in the legal portion of these costs that we had. I don't know if you're aware of that, but it was $3.7 million that we were supposedly. What were those for?
Specifically with permit delays?
That's correct.
Is that the slide you're looking at? Well, that'll be an ongoing. We have to pursue the insurance carrier. So that's the beginning of that process.
Well, we're only going to have $10 million possible recovery, right?
Well, it's the principal, and I'm sure as a part of their case, it'll be court costs as well, or legal costs. I can't answer that definitively, but I'm only hoping that that's part of their claim.
All right, thank you.
Representative Roper.
Thank you, Chairman.
Mr. Knudsen, I'm looking through the slides here and trying to add this up. I come up with a figure of $207 million. Right now, the $49 million to complete the initial scoping, and then I think it's 158 if I'm adding it up right. The $63 million needed in 04 for Concourse C completion and the south terminal design and prep. And then there's $5 million for south terminal. Add that up to $207 million. Is that correct?
Well, I think you may have a double count there. There's $13 million for the AB design.
Right.
There's $50 million basically rounding for completion of C, that's 63,
right.
Plus the 108, 103, I'm not sure what the number
is. There's 95 on this.
Well, okay, 95. So
that's 158 million.
Yeah, that's
then there's the 49 million for the original project.
No, that's the double count. It's 49 plus 13 plus 95.
That's right. But it says it does not, the $49 million does not include the south terminal.
That is correct.
The double count?
The 49 is the C completion, 13 is A and B design, and then 95 is the...
Got it. So it's $158 million.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
That's why I wanted to clarify it there. It's not...
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Chairman, I guess if you... Oh, well...
We might have other questions after we get through here. Who's up next?
But if you want an update on last night's storm, Mark would be delighted.
Yeah, we'd like to get Mark up here.
A brief update. Briefly.
Just make sure everybody's a hero.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Mark Plum. That's P-L-U-M-B, Director of Ted Stevens, Anchorage International Airport.
First, before we get into anything, why don't you tell us about the windstorm?
Yes, sir.
Then we'll get into everything.
Last night, Anchorage, as a result of heavy winds, the FAA closed the tower at 11:27. The winds were reported on the top of the tower at approximately 90 knots. The high winds created unsafe and extremely dangerous condition for the controllers up there, and they evacuated. The winds on the surface were being clocked at 45 to 50 knots. The winds damaged terminal buildings, facilities, fences, as well as the blue equipment, carts, and other debris across the runways and taxiways, to include the wing of a old DC-3. Peak winds on the airfield were reported at 75 knots. The tower reported a peak of 95 knots. The terminals were closed down shortly after that, after the airfield was closed, and we assisted the passengers in leaving the terminal to make other arrangements. Extensive emergency actions were taken to facilitate the airfield and terminal closures in an orderly fashion. We called in additional airport staff. I believe the team did a tremendous job up there. Our police force, our facilities maintenance people, our airfield maintenance people, and operations teams all assisted with securing the airfield as well as helping the passengers get to other places. Plans were developed and coordinated with the FAA and the airlines to reopen the airport contingent on the winds being below 25 knots. Initially, due to the forecast, we believe that would occur around 12 o'clock today. During the early morning hours, the crews working on the runways. We're able to complete enough of the clearing that we're able to move that up. So by 9 o'clock in the morning, we were able to let non-passenger airplanes land. By 10 o'clock, we had passenger airplanes landing. And by 12 o'clock today, we were in full operation. Again, the forecast was that winds may exceed our 25-knot limit later on today, so we're keeping a very close eye on that. Damage to the airport facilities was fairly extensive. Most of the damage occurred in the A concourse. That's the old Mark Air concourse. There was approximately 67,000 square feet of damaged roof. There was about 1.8 million pounds of roofing material, insulation pavers that either shifted or were blown off. Additionally, approximately 28,000 feet of membrane and other roofing material was damaged over the B concourse. The new concourse C also received some damage, and we are not sure exactly what the cost or the extent of that at the current time. The extremely high winds and low temperatures combined to cause significant wind chill problems that have reduced the interior temperatures, and they exist as we speak now. This was further compounded by the numerous and somewhat open connections between the new terminal and the old terminal sections. Numerous pipes have broken. Some of these are critical heating water lines. In addition to numerous emergency crew call-outs and holdovers, the airport has requested and received considerable assistance from the Kiewit Construction Company to attempt to gain control of the heating systems and temporary roof repairs. The bottom line is we've had a major emergency caused by high winds and low temperatures. The airport is now back in full operation. We are very vigilant, of course, on the forecast for the winds. We do continue to have numerous facility problems. Costs are undetermined. There are approximate costs on the roofing area right now of at least $500,000. Checking on when the A roof was put on was about 7 years ago, and it is in the CIP program to be replaced, so that should mitigate some of those costs. That would conclude my remarks on the windstorm as I know them.
What, on the, you know, as we drive up to the departure on the top, I noticed for about a year now there's been exposed insulation in this thing. How, why was it left as open and not finished up on the outside? Or maybe that you're not the construction guy. Maybe
you're correct, Senator Cowdery. I'm not the construction guy. The best I can determine, that was put up as temporary walls to keep the heat in. And in fact, that will be replaced by glass glazing in the near future.
How many aircraft were diverted during that emergency period from until this morning or until this
afternoon? Sir, I don't have the exact number. I talked to Fairbanks at 3:30 this morning, and they had 10 aircraft on the ground. They confirmed that they could accept 14 more if we needed to by using the taxiways and runways, the GA runway.
Just a quick follow-up. There was a time, I think, when they were also diverted to your military base there. That's probably after the 9/11 and security measures taken now. Is that now off-limits to diverted aircraft from international?
Not to my knowledge, sir. Elmendorf, for weather or emergency alternates, could still be used.
Could still be used. Okay, yes. Thank you.
Well, the wind was blowing probably at Elmendorf.
They're probably blowing there. You're correct. Cold Bay, King Salmon, Galena, Eielson, as well as Fairbanks, are all certainly airports that should be considered.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Pines. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Plummer, the 25 knots that you were just talking about, is that a safety level set by the airport or is by the airlines? Or
flight restrictions on aircraft are set by the manufacturer, and airlines may modify those. That the 25 knots was just a figure we used as an approximate figure. There's no regulation that dictates 25 knots that I know of, or other than that being the crosswind limitation on a T-38.
Was there any other damage? And we're talking about the main airport, but like Lake Hood and the Lake Hood Strip and the planes there and other planes that were on the main airport there, was there damage there?
Yes, sir. It's my understanding, the last count, there were 31 general aviation aircraft that were damaged at around the Lake Hood, Lake Spinard, and the tie-down areas.
And the commercial aircraft that at Ted Stevens, was any of those damaged?
I have no reports of any damage. There were many carts and igloos and other things that were blown across. We lost a lot of signage. We lost some of our VASIs. We're still looking for
what that means to the non-pilot.
It's a visual approach. It's a set of lights that are set up red over white, and so you want to sort of have that in your queue as you come down and assist in landing at the proper location on the runway.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Plum, I was wondering, as you reiterated some of the damage that's happened last night, I guess who's going to pay for that? Is the airport authority or the management of the airport going to come to the legislature for some additional funding for the repair of some of these?
We are self-insured.
Especially considering the construction area damage that has happened.
We will have to determine certainly the total cost. The cost of the property that is damaged, the state property, will be borne by the AIAS, and that would come out of our revenue fund. Yes, sir.
Thank you. We have, I'd like you to maybe get back up here after this, but we have people online that wants to testify, and Alaska Airlines maybe could answer some of our questions. Cliff Argue, if there's no more questions of Mr. Plum at this time. Senator Olson.
Actually, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a number of questions that have are related to this, but if I can either ask them now, and I'm not even sure who the best person to go ahead and answer the questions are, and it has to do mainly with the over budget, behind schedule, and the issues related to the passenger terminal. But I can certainly wait till after the end. And after
I was just thinking, courtesy to the people that's been online, that we hear them and ask them, and then the rest of us here in the room, we can stay here till midnight to order pizzas, I guess. But anyway, I'm going to charge you to the airport.
Thank you,
Mark, Chairman.
Thanks, Mark.
And is Cliff, are you online?
Yes, Senator, I am.
Would you identify yourself and... I'm sorry for the delay, but there was a lot of questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Cliff Argue. It's spelled A-R-G-U-E. I am Staff Vice President of Properties and Facilities for Alaska Airlines, and I also serve as Chair of the Anchorage and Fairbanks Airlines Airport Affairs Committee, which is comprised of representatives of the signatory carriers, some 26 airlines serving the two airports. I very much appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and apologize that I was not able to be there in person at every intention, but obviously weather intervened and I was not able to get there. With me here in my office today are two consultants that have worked very closely with the airlines and the airports in Anchorage and Fairbanks, Mr. Jim Burchette and Mr. Matt Ross of the firm Airport and Aviation Professionals from Naples, Florida. They have represented both technical as well as financial consulting for us. There are other airline representatives, I believe, at the Anchorage LIO, and they may have further comments later in this hearing, as time permitted. Before I get into the specific Anchorage CIP issues, I think it's important because it's been referenced somewhat in the conversation and discussion so far to give a little bit of the background and context of the airline industry crisis that we're currently facing. It's well known, and I'm sure you see almost daily media reports, as we all do, about the seriousness of this situation for the airline industry. Despite the figures that Deputy Commissioner Knutson gave for the Anchorage Airport, in general, throughout the country and even in the world, traffic is down. Some people are just not traveling at this point. Fuel costs are up over 120% in the last year, and I recognize that higher oil prices may be good in many respects for the state of Alaska, but they do cost the airlines dearly. And just for the U.S. domestic carriers, 1 cent per gallon increase in the cost of jet fuel equates to $450 million in additional cost over a year's time. For Alaska Airlines, that number is 1 cent per gallon is $3.5 million just for our airline on a year's basis. And with the cost more than doubling from in the 50 and 60 cent range to over $1.20, $1.30 per gallon, anyone can do the math and see what the impact is on the carriers. Last year, the U.S. Airlines lost together over $11 billion. And those losses continue. The forecasts are anywhere from $5 to $8 billion lost by the airlines this year. There's 100,000 former airline employees that are looking for work that have been furloughed, and there's probably more layoffs to come in the future. 566 aircraft are parked in the desert, being non-productive. These are aircraft that were flying in U.S. Skies about 2 years ago. As was mentioned earlier, two major U.S. airlines are in bankruptcy. That's U.S. Airways and United Airlines. And there could be more in the near future. Certainly a lot of speculation about possibly American Airlines and possibly others. The crisis has been made worse by government policy and taxation. Today, over 25% of an average ticket price goes to taxes and fees imposed by the government, where back in 1972, that was only 7%, and as recently as 1992, it was only 15%. That's a higher percentage than taxes on cigarettes, liquor, gas, and many other commodities that we all purchase. It was mentioned also by Mr. Eberle and others, Deputy Commissioner Knutson, on the unfunded mandates that we're facing from the Transportation Security Administration. And those costs are another huge exposure to the airlines as we face going forward here, and not even knowing all of the requirements that we might be forced to implement. Just 2 days ago, the Air Transport Association, which represents the major scheduled U.S. airlines, issued an excellent report, Airlines in Crisis, discussing not only the details of what's happened in the past, but the very real concerns of what will happen to this industry going forward if there is a shooting war that breaks out. And they're talking in terms of possibly as many as another 70,000 employees losing their jobs, additional aircraft being parked, and it's apparent, bankruptcy, but the actual liquidity are more carriers. And I can provide the staff, Mr. Chairman, with the reference for that so that the copies can be made available to the committee members. Costs are a major concern to the carriers. I will note that the airlines have done a great deal of self-help to reduce these costs. As I've noted above, we've also gone to seek concessions from our labor groups, our suppliers, and just about every possible avenue to reduce costs been explored. And a key element of this are airport costs. They're very much a part of this equation, and they must likewise be addressed. A number of airports across the country have recognized the unique partnership between airlines and airports and made significant reductions in both operating and capital spending. In Minneapolis, Tampa, Dallas-Fort Worth, just to name a few, have cut back tremendously on their capital programs as well as in their operating costs. Since September 11th, we have been in constant communication with the Department of Transportation of the state of Alaska, as well as in the AIS staff, to do similar reductions. And some actions have been taken on the operating side, but so far we feel that much more is needed. Capital program, I'll talk about that in just a minute. Again, just to highlight, because I think it's important to be said in several different ways, that AIAS, the Alaska International Airport System, is a self-funded enterprise fund. There are no general fund dollars in or out. The fees and charges are paid by the airlines, concessions, parking revenues, and federal grants, as well as passenger facility charges. And it's important to note also that under the residual operating agreement, which Deputy Commissioner Knutson explained briefly earlier, under this residual agreement, the airlines are basically on the hook to make up any shortfall. So the buck stops with us. And if there is a shortfall in revenues from another source or an airline that pulls out, it's the airlines that make up the difference at the end of the day. Also, the bonds that are issued are not general obligations of the state of Alaska. They do not go against the full faith and credit of the state, but they are separate airport revenue bonds. As part of the new operating agreement, the airlines did agree to fund a capital improvement program for the two airports, in addition to the ongoing Anchorage project. The cost overrun situation has been well explained by Mr. Eberle and Deputy Commissioner Knutson, so I won't dwell on that. I think they did really an excellent job of going through all of the details and the reasons that we are where we are. But now that we're faced with a project that is under construction and the need to finish that work, as well as provide the other domestic carriers who will occupy terminals or the concourses A and B, the airlines firmly believe that that should be the top priority of the airport, to get that terminal work done so that everyone enjoys equal facilities as they were promised going into this project. It's really going to take two things to get there. One is to reduce, and that's to defer or perhaps in some cases cancel other capital improvement projects, and to sell more bonds. And you've already heard the need that would be coming forward to sell additional bonds. We've been working for a number of months jointly to reach the solution between the airlines and the AIAS. We agree that more bonds are necessary, but as I mentioned a minute ago, we also need to see some significant deferrals or perhaps cancellations of other CIP projects and reduction in scope of existing projects, as well as creative use of funding sources. Again, in concert with what Deputy Commissioner Knutson said, all of those things are being explored. And in just a second, I'll mention some specific areas that we have put forward that we're looking to continue to discuss with the airport. Our goal is not only to stay within the original cost projections that were done before 9/11 and when the operating agreement was signed, but given the fact that we're in a whole new world now, we'd like to see some significant savings so that the airlines serving Anchorage and Fairbanks will continue to provide the level of service to the people of the state of Alaska, as well as to have that cargo traffic coming through there. Deputy Commissioner Knutson mentioned that it may be favorable compared with certain other airports, and that may well be true, but comparisons like that can always be tricky, and we have to look at each individual airport and what the costs are at that location when we're judging how the funding and how the rates and charges stack up. Having said that, we recognize that continued negotiations will be necessary between the airlines and the airport system to find an agreement that works for all parties. We have proposed a five-point program that many of the features are acceptable to both sides, and many of those were mentioned earlier by Deputy Commissioner Knutson as well. We're looking at deferring. In our estimation, we need to defer about $67 million previously approved CIP projects out to a later time frame. But want to be careful that in each case we maximize and don't give up any eligibility for full federal funding entitlement to come for the improvement program. If necessary, we need to perhaps cancel and reconsider some of those projects in later years. Reducing project scope, we've already talked about. Eliminating the nice-to-have features in some of these facilities is very important. We believe that a three-year extension of the existing operating agreement is important. That's part of our negotiations. And then also, again, as was mentioned, to obtain maximum federal funding from the Transportation Security Administration for all of these security mandates, the baggage systems especially, that we must put in the terminal. And then looking to extend the passenger facility charge use as matching grants for some of the federal funding. These are difficult times for the airline industry, which is everyone knows is such a vital part of the economy and the daily life of the state of Alaska. These difficult times require difficult actions, in some cases deferring projects that were very useful and needed before, but if they've not begun yet, perhaps they can be finished at a later time. It's important, though, to complete the terminal project so that that can become useful as promised to all of the airlines and become revenue producing as soon as possible. We look to the state of Alaska to continue to be partners with the airlines in this time of crisis and to help ensure the future viability of the critical air transportation system throughout the state, the country, and the world. We stand ready to work very closely with DOT on this, and thank you for the opportunity again, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee to make this presentation today. Certainly, I'd like to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Argue, I just want to make sure you're going to stay online since you are, I'm assuming you're the only representative of the Airlines Airport Affairs Committee.
Senator and Mr. Chairman, yes, I'll stay on the line. I believe there are other representatives, members of the committee that may be at the Anchorage LIO. I believe Mr. Landis from Air Aviation, who is a member of our executive committee as well, is probably on the line, and there may be others there as well, but I will stay on as long as you wish.
Thank you very much.
You have a question?
Yeah, this is Senator Wagner. You mentioned you gave us a little bit of an economic lesson. What's your prices on fuel other parts of the country?
Prices on jet fuel vary around the country. I do not have a chart that shows it that city by city, but the entire jet fuel market has increased substantially over the last year, about 120% on average. I do not have the specific jet fuel prices. Those are contract rates that we have with the different fuel company suppliers at different locations.
Okay. You want to follow up?
Well, the only follow-up...
I think Mort can probably answer that question.
I was just going to be a little more specific and just throw out maybe L.A., Frisco, and Seattle then compared to Anchorage and Fairbanks.
Are you talking again about fuel prices?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I do not have those numbers, I'm sorry. And typically, I believe most airlines and probably ourselves don't disclose individual location prices because of those are proprietary contracts with the suppliers at those locations.
Okay, thank you. We have one other question about landing fees. How does landing fees compare here in Anchorage or in Alaska, Anchorage and Fairbanks, say, with other places, and follow that up? The landing fees cost you the same on an empty airplane as it does a full airplane, or is there any proration or anything like that? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, landing fees are charged on the certificated gross weight of the aircraft. In the case of Anchorage and Fairbanks, that is on the certificated gross takeoff weight of the aircraft as set by the manufacturer. In most other locations throughout the country, is based on the certificated gross landing weight. Takeoff weight being higher because when you take off, you're full of fuel. So whether your flight is, has 10 people on it or 110 people, you would pay the same amount for a landing fee at a particular location. It's also somewhat dangerous to compare only landing fees between airports because at every airport we have a different business arrangement. And in some cases, costs at one airport are included in the terminal rental rates or in other areas of charges, where at other airports they may be included in landing fees or fuel flowage fee. So it's, again, very difficult to compare airport to airport unless you look at a total cost picture of the, on some measure, such as a cost per in-plane passenger or something.
Okay, thank you. Is there any other questions on that? We have, let's see, listen only. We have people online. How about Tom George? Are you there, Tom?
Yeah, this is Tom George in Fairbanks.
Okay, and, please go, continue.
Yes, the last name's G-E-O-R-G-E. I represent the Alaska, or I'm the Alaska representative of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association. And obviously most of our interests are, with general aviation, or which is a stakeholder, but a very small stakeholder in comparison to the airlines you've heard from today. And I guess at this point, all I'd say is that we, I think, also support being conservative in spending and would look forward to working with DOT to and the airlines and the other users of the airport to do the best we can to kind of work our way through this situation. And that's all I've got at the moment. I originally thought this was going to be a broader topic, but I appreciate the opportunity to participate in the education on the situation with the terminal there in Anchorage International.
Thank you, Mr. George. This is Representative Holm. Appreciate all you do.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. George, I think that you bring up certainly a central issue when we look at some of the goings on, and I think what has happened so far is we've looked at some specific budget overruns and behind schedule problems that are happening there, but they do affect the general aviation community, and I guess I'm looking to see if we have more general aviation input out there, because what funds are available at this airport, if they are going to in one way or another affect the general aviation people in the state of Alaska, realizing that this is a state airport owned by the people of the state of Alaska. I'm assuming it's made for the people of the state of Alaska, and most of our discussion this afternoon has been oriented toward people that are tenants that may be here today and may be gone tomorrow, depending on how long the contract is. I guess if there are people out there with general aviation concerns, this is the time to go ahead and voice them, because that's the people that have been calling my office, and so I don't think, Mr. George, with all due respect to those that have presented before, that this discussion is not just oriented toward the larger carriers.
Okay, well, I'll add a little bit more then, because certainly, yes, there are concerns with general aviation at the airport, and I guess the place that they probably play into your current discussion is on the list of projects that might be deferred or changes the airport might make, and our desire certainly would the general aviation be considered in that equation. As has been stated earlier, the two Anchorage and Fairbanks, the international airports, are funded separately from the rural airports, and that's, again, probably a topic for another day, but we're certainly interested in making sure the general aviation has a strong ability to use the facilities at the airport, since that's also part of our transportation connection to rural Alaska and the rest of the state. And I mean, if there's other things that people want to go into at the moment, I'd be happy to try and address those.
Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Olson.
If I could continue, Mr. George, I want to make sure it's fairly clear that there is going to be an interaction between General Aviation and some of the larger carriers that are there, not just from a financial standpoint, but just also from the physical standpoint, where there have been the observation, if not the complaint, that General Aviation is being... to a certain degree denied access to some of the facilities at the airport. And whether that's true or not, I guess I want to hear if that is, and if anybody does have any firsthand knowledge of that, that needs to be voiced at this time, because we're all here from the commissioner on down to the airport manager.
Okay, well, the principal concern I'm aware of, and I think there are other speakers that are probably slated to talk that could go into this in more detail or may have other things to add, but certainly are some of the concerns